Labor Day deals are looking good at Lowe's. Save $10 on 1 gallon cans and $50 on 5 gallon pails of select interior paint via rebate. Plus, get two 2.5 quart or 3 quart Mums for just $8. A fresh look and savings? Even better. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Mum sizes vary by location and exclude Alaska and Hawaii. See store at Lowe's.com for more details.
L-E-T-E-N-E-T. Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 100% match on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Our tale tonight comes from author William Hope Hodgson. It's entitled The Hog, Parts 1 through 3. We had finished dinner, and Carnacki had drawn his big chair up to the fire and started his pipe. Jessup, Arkwright, Taylor, and I had each taken our favorite positions and waited for Carnacki to begin. "What am I going to tell you about happened in the next room?" he said, after drawing at his pipe for a while. It had been a terrible experience. Dr. Whitten first brought the case to my notice. We'd been chatting over a pipe at the club one night about an article in The Lancet, and Whitten mentioned having just such a similar case in a man called Baines. I was interested at once. It was one of those cases of a gap or flaw in a man's protection barrier, I call it. A failure to be what I might term efficiently insulated spiritually from the outer monstrosities. From what I knew of Whitten, I knew he'd be of no use. Y'all know Whitten, a decent sort, hard-headed, practical, stand-no-kind-of-nonsense sort of man, all right at his own job when that job's a fractured leg or a broken collarbone, but he'd never have made anything of the Baines case. For a space, Carnacki puffed meditatively at his pipe, and we waited for him to go on with his tale. "I told Whitten to send Baines to me," he resumed, "and the following Saturday he came up. A little sensitive man, I liked him as soon as I set eyes on him. After a bit, I got him to explain what was troubling him, and questioned him about what Dr. Whitten had called his dreams. They're more than dreams, he said. They're so real that they're actual experiences to me. They're simply horrible. And yet there's nothing very definitive in them to tell you what. They generally come just as I am going off to sleep. I'm hardly over before suddenly I seem to have gotten down into some deep, vague place with some inexplicable and frightful horror all about me. I can never understand what it is, for I never see anything. Only I always get a sudden knowledge, like a warning, that I have got down into some terrible place, a sort of hell place, I might call it, where I've no business ever to have wandered. And the warning is always insistent, even imperative, that I must get out. Get out or some enormous horror will come at me. "Can't you pull yourself back?" I asked him. "Can't you wake up?" "No," he told me. "That's just what I can't do, try as I will. I can't stop going along this labyrinth of hell, as I call it to myself, towards some dreadful unknown horror. The warning is repeated ever so strongly, almost as if the live me of my waking moments was awake and aware. Something seems to warn me to wake up, that whatever I do, I must wake, wake, and then my consciousness comes suddenly alive, and I know that my body is there in the bed, but my essence or spirit is still down there in that hell, whatever it is, in a danger that is both unknown and inexpressible, but so overwhelming that my whole spirit seems sick with terror. I keep saying to myself all the time that I must wake up," he continued, "but it is as if my spirit is still down there, and as if my consciousness knows that some tremendous invisible power is fighting against me. I know that if I do not wake then, I shall never wake up again, but go down deeper and deeper into some stupendous horror of soul destruction. So then I fight. My body lies in the bed there and pulls, and the power down there in the labyrinth exerts itself too, so that a feeling of despair greater than any I have ever known on this earth comes on me. I know that if I give way and cease to fight and do not wake, then I shall pass out to that monstrous horror which seems to be silently calling my soul to destruction. Then I make a final stupendous effort," he continued, "and my brain seems to fill my body like the ghost of my soul. I can even open my eyes and see with my brain, or consciousness, out of my own eyes. I can see the bedclothes, and I know just how I am laying in the bed, yet the real me is down in that hell in terrible danger. Can you get me?" he asked. "Perfectly," I replied. "Well, you know," he went on, "I fight and fight. Down there is that great pit my very soul seems to shrink back from the call of some brooding horror that impels it silently a little further, always a little further round a visible corner, which if I once pass, I know I shall never return again to this world. Desperately I fight brain and consciousness, fighting together to help it. The agony is so great that I could scream, were it not that I am rigid and frozen in the bed with fear. Then, just when my strength seems almost gone, soul and body win and blend slowly, and I lie there, worn out with this terrible, extraordinary fight. I still have a sense of a dreadful horror all about me, as if out of that horrible place some brooding monstrosity had followed me up and hang still and silent and invisible over me, threatening me there in my bed. Do I make it clear to you?" he asked. "It's like some monstrous presence." "Yes," I said. "I follow you." The man's forehead was actually covered with sweat, so keenly did he live again through the horrors he had experienced. After a while, he continued, "Now comes the most curious part of the dream, or whatever it is," he said. "There's always a sound I hear as I lie there exhausted in the bed. It comes while the bedroom is still full of the sort of atmosphere of monstrosity that seems to come up with me when I get out of that place. I hear the sound coming out of that enormous depth, and it is always the noise of pigs. Pigs grunting, you know? It's simply dreadful. The dream is always the same. Sometimes I've had it every single night for a week, until I fight not to go to sleep. But of course I have to sleep sometimes. I think that's how a person might go mad, don't you? He finished. I nodded and looked at his sensitive face. Poor beggar. He had been through it, and no mistake. Tell me some more, I said. The grunting, what does it sound like exactly? It's just like pigs, he told me again. Only much more awful. There are grunts and squeals and pig howls, like you hear when their food is being brought to them at the pig farm. You know those large pig farms where they keep hundreds of pigs? All the grunts, squeals, and howls blend into one brutal chaos of sound. Only it isn't chaos. It all blends in a queer, horrible way. I've heard it. A sort of swinish, clamoring melody that grunts and groans and shrieks and chunks of grunting sounds, all tied together with squealings and shot through with pig howls. I've sometimes thought there was a definite beat in it, for every now and again there comes a gargantuan grunt, breaking through the million pig-voiced roaring, a stupendous grunt that comes in with a beat. Can you understand me? It seems to shake everything. It's like a spiritual earthquake. The howling, squealing, grunting, rolling clamor of swinish noise coming up out of that place, and then the monstrous grunt rising up through it all, an ever-recurring beat out of the depth, the voice of the swine mother of monstrosity beating up from below through that chorus of mad swine hunger. It's no use. I can't explain it. No one ever could. It's just terrible. And I'm afraid you're saying to yourself that I'm in a bad way, that I want a change or a tonic, that I must buck up or I'll land myself in a madhouse. If only you could understand. Dr. Whitten seemed to half understand, I thought. But I know he only sent me to you as a sort of last hope. He thinks I'm booked for the asylum, I could tell it. Nonsense, I said. Don't talk such rubbish. You're as sane as I am. Your ability to think clearly what you want to tell me, and then to transmit it to me so well that you compel my mental retina to see something of what you have seen, stands sponsor for your mental health. I'm going to investigate your case, and if it is what I suspect, one of those rare instances of a flaw or a gap in your protective barrier, what I might call your spiritual insulation from the outer monstrosities, I've no doubt we can end the trouble. But we've got to go properly into the matter first, and there will certainly be danger in doing so. I'll risk it, replied Baines. I can't go on like this any longer. Very well, I told him. Go out now and come back at 5 o'clock. I shall be ready for you then. And don't worry about your sanity. You're all right. And you'll soon make things safe for you again. Just keep cheerful and don't brood about it. I put in the whole afternoon preparing my experimenting room across the landing there for his case. When he returned at 5 o'clock, I was ready for him and took him straight into the room. It gets dark now about 6:30, as you know, and I had just nice time before it grew dusk to finish my arrangements. I prefer always to be ready before the dark comes. Baines touched my elbow as we walked into the room. There's something I ought to have told you, he said, looking rather sheepish. I've somehow felt a bit ashamed of it. Out with it, I replied. He hesitated a moment, then it came out with a jerk. I told you about the grunting of the pigs, he said. Well, I grunt too. I know it's horrible. When I lie there in bed and hear these sounds after I've come up, I just grunt back as if in reply. I can't stop myself, I just do it. Something makes me. I never told Dr. Whitten that. I couldn't. I'm sure now you think me mad, he concluded. He looked into my face, anxious and queerly ashamed. It's only the natural sequence of the abnormal events, and I'm glad you told me, I said, slapping him on the back. It follows logically on that what you have already told me. I've had two cases that in some way resembles yours. What happened? He asked me. Did they get better? One of them is alive and well today, Mr. Baines, I replied. The other man lost his nerve, and fortunately for all concerned, he is dead. I shut the door and locked it as I spoke, and Baines stared round, rather alarmed, I fancy, at my apparatus. What are you going to do? He asked. Will it be a dangerous experiment? Dangerous enough, I answered, if you fail to follow my instructions absolutely in everything. We both run the risk of never leaving this room alive. Have I your word that I can depend on you to obey me, whatever happens? He stared around the room and then back at me. Yes, he replied. And you know, I felt he would prove the right kind of stuff when the moment came. I began now to get things fully in train for the night's work. I told Baines to take off his coat and his boots. Then I dressed him entirely from head to foot in a single thick rubber combination overall with rubber gloves and a helmet with air flaps of the same material attached. I dressed myself in a similar suit. Then I began on the next stage of the night's preparations. First, I must tell you that the room measures 39 feet by 37 and has a plain board door over which is fitted a heavy half-inch rubber covering. I had cleared the floor entirely, all but the exact center where I placed a glass-legged upholstered table, a pile of vacuum tubes and batteries, and three pieces of special apparatus which my experiment required. Now, Baines, I recalled, come and stand over here by this table. Don't move about. I've got to erect a protective barrier around us, and on no account must either of us cross over it by even so much as a foot or a hand once it's built. We went over to the middle of the room, and he stood by the glass-legged table while I began to fit the vacuum tubing together around us. I intended to use the new spectrum defense, which I had been perfecting lately. This, I must tell you, consists of seven glass vacuum circles with the red on the outside and the color circles lying inside it, in the order of orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. The room was still fairly light, but a slight quantity of dusk seemed to be already in the atmosphere, and I worked quickly. Suddenly, as I fitted the glass tubes together, I was aware of some vague sense of nerve strain, and glancing round at Baines, who was standing there by the table, I noticed him staring fixedly before him. He looked absolutely drowned in uncomfortable memories. "For goodness sake, stop thinking of those horrors," I called out to him. "I shall want you to think hard enough about them later. But in this specially constructed room, it is better not to dwell on things of that kind till the barriers are up. Keep your mind on anything normal or superficial. The theater will do. Think about that last piece you saw at the Gaiety. I'll talk to you in a moment." 20 minutes later, the barrier was completed all around us, and I connected up the batteries. The room by this time was graying with the coming dusk, and the seven differently colored circles shone out with extraordinary effect, sending out a cold glare. "By Jove!" cried Baines. "That's very wonderful, very wonderful." My other apparatus, which I now began to arrange, consisted of a specially made camera, a modified form of phonograph with earpieces instead of a horn, and a glass disc composed of many fathoms of glass vacuum tubes, arranged in a special way. It had two wires leading to an electrode constructed to fit around the head. By the time I had looked over and fixed up these three things, night had practically come, and the darkened room shone most strangely in the curious upward glare of the seven vacuum tubes. "Now, Baines," I said, "I want you to lie on this table. Now, Put your hands down by your sides and lie quiet and think. You've just got two things to do, I told him. One is to lie there and concentrate your thoughts on the details of the dream you are always having, and the other is not to move off this table whatever you see or hear, or whatever happens unless I tell you. You understand, don't you? Yes, he answered. I think you may rely on me not to make a fool of myself. I feel curiously safe with you somehow. I'm glad of that, I replied. But I don't want you to minimize the possible danger too much. There may be horrible danger. Now, just let me fix this band on your head, I added as I adjusted the electrode. I gave him a few more instructions, telling him to concentrate his thoughts, particularly on the noises he had just heard as he was waking, and I warned him again not to let himself fall asleep. Don't talk, I said, and don't take any notice of me. If you find I disturb your concentration, keep your eyes closed. He laid back, and I walked over to the glass disc, arranging the camera in front of us on its stand in such a way that the lens was opposite the center of the disc. I had scarcely done this when a ripple of greenish light ran across the vacuum tubes of the desk. This vanished, and for maybe a minute there was complete darkness. Then the green light rippled once more across it, rippled and swung round, and began to dance in varying shades from a deep heavy green to a rank ugly shade, back and forward, back and forward. Every half second or so, there shot across the varying greens a flicker of yellow, an ugly, heavy, repulsive yellow. And then abruptly, there came sweeping across the disk a great beat of muddy red. This died as quickly as it came and gave place to the changing greens shot through by the unpleasant and ugly yellow hues. About every seventh second, the disk was submerged, and the other colors, momentarily blotted out by the great beat of heavy, muddy red which swept over everything. He's concentrating on those sounds, I said to myself, and I felt queerly excited as I hurried on with my operations. I threw a word over my shoulder to Baines. Don't get scared, whatever happens, I said. You're all right. I proceeded down to open my camera. It had a long roll of specially prepared paper ribbon in place of a film or plates. By turning the handle, the roll passed through the machine, exposing the ribbon. It took about 5 minutes to finish the roll, and during all that time, the green lights predominated. But the dull, heavy beat of muddy red never ceased to flow across the vacuum tubes of the disc at every seventh second. It was like a recurrent beat in some unheard and somehow displeasing melody. Lifting the exposed spool of paper ribbon out of the camera, I laid it horizontally in the two rests that I had arranged for it on my modified gramophone. Where the paper had been acted upon by the varying colored lights which had appeared on the disc, the prepared surface had risen in curious, irregular little waves. I unrolled about a foot of the ribbon and attached the loose end to the empty spool roller on the opposite side of the machine, which I had geared to the driving clockwork mechanism of the gramophone. Then I took the diaphragm and lowered it gently into place above the ribbon. Instead of the usual needle the diaphragm was fitted with, a beautifully made metal filament brush, about an inch broad, which just covered the whole breadth of the ribbon. This fine and fragile brush rested lightly on the prepared surface of the paper, and when I started the machine, the ribbon began to pass under the brush, and as it passed, the delicate metal filament bristles followed every minute of inequality of those tiny, irregular, wave-like excrescences on the surface. I put the earpieces to my ears, and instantly I knew that I had succeeded in actually recording what Baines had heard in his sleep. In fact, I was even then hearing mentally by means of his effort of memory. I was listening to what appeared to be the faint, far-off squealing and grunting of countless swine. It was extraordinary, and at the same time exquisitely horrible and vile. It frightened me with a sense of my having come suddenly and unexpectedly too near to something foul and most abominably dangerous. So strong and imperative was this feeling that I twitched the earpieces out of my ears and sat a while staring around the room trying to steady my sensations back to normality. The room looked strange and vague in the dull glow of light from the circles, and I had a feeling that a taint of monstrosity was all about me in the air. I remembered what Baines had told me of the feeling he'd always had after coming up out of that place, as if some horrible atmosphere had followed him up and filled his bedroom. I understood him perfectly now, so much so that I had mentally used almost his exact phrase in explaining to myself what I felt. Turning around to speak to him, I saw there was something curious about the center of the defense. Now, before I tell you fellows any more, I must explain that there were certain, what I call focusing, qualities about this new defense I've been trying. The Sigurd manuscript puts it something like this: "Avoid diversities of color, nor stand ye within the barrier of the color lights. For in color hath Satan a delight, nor can he abide in the deep of ye adventure against him, armed with red-purple. So be warned. Neither forget that in blue, which is God's color in the heavens, ye have safety." You see, from that statement in the Sigurd manuscript, I got my first notion for this new defense of mine. I've aimed to make it a defense and yet have focusing or drawing qualities such as Sigson hints at. I have experimented enormously and have proved that reds and purples, the two extreme colors of the spectrum, are fairly dangerous, so much so that I suspect they actually draw or focus the outside forces. Any action or meddling on the part of the experimentalist is tremendously enhanced in its effect if the action is taken within barriers composed of these colors in certain proportions and tints. In the same way blue is distinctly a general defense, yellow appears to be neutral, and green a wonderful protection within limits. Orange, as far as I can tell, is slightly attractive, and indigo is dangerous by itself in a limited way, but in certain combinations with other colors, it becomes a very powerful defense. I have not yet discovered a tenth of the possibilities of these circles of mine. It's a kind of color organ upon which I seem to play a tune of color combinations that can be either safe or infernal in its effects. You know I have a keyboard with a separate switch to each of the color circles. Well, you fellows will understand now what I felt when I saw the curious appearance on the floor in the middle of the defense. It looked exactly as if a circular shadow lay, not just on the floor, but a few inches above it. The shadow seemed to deepen and blacken at the center, even while I watched it. It appeared to be spreading from the center outwardly, and all the time it grew darker. I was watchful and not a little puzzled, for the combination of lights that I had switched on approximated a moderately safe general use. Understand, I had no intention of making a focus until I had learned more. In fact, I meant that first investigation not to go beyond a tentative inquiry into the kind of thing I had got to deal with. I knelt down quickly and felt the floor with the palm of my hand, but it was quite normal to the feel, and that reassured me that there was no satiae mischief aboard, for that is a form of danger which can involve and make use of the very material of the defense itself. It can materialize out of everything except fire. As I knelt there, I realized all at once that the legs of the table on which Baines lay were partly hidden by the ever-blackening shadow, and my hands seemed to grow vague as I felt at the floor. I got up and stood a couple feet so as to see the phenomenon from a little distance. It struck me then that there was something different about the table itself. It seemed unaccountably lower. In the shadow, hiding the legs, I thought to myself. This promises to be interesting, but I'd better not let things go too far. I called out to Baines to stop thinking so hard. Stop concentrating for a bit, I said. But he never answered, and it occurred to me suddenly that the table appeared to be still lower. Baines! I shouted. Stop thinking a moment! Then in a flash I realized it. Wake up, man! Wake up! I cried. He had fallen asleep, the very last thing he should have done, for it increased the danger twofold. No wonder I'd been getting such good results. The poor beggar was worn out with his sleepless nights. He neither moved nor spoke as I strode across to him. Wake up! I shouted again, shaking him by the shoulder. My voice echoed uncomfortably around the empty big room, and Baines lay like a dead man. As I shook him again, I noticed that I appeared to be standing up to my knees in the circular shadow. It looked like the mouth of a pit. My legs, from the knees downward, were vague. The floor under my feet felt solid and firm when I stamped on it. But all the same, I had a feeling that things were going a bit too far, so striding across to the switchboard, I switched on the full defense. Stepping back quickly from the table, I had a horrible and sickening shock. The table had sunk quite unmistakably. Its top was within a couple of feet of the floor, and the legs had that foreshortened appearance that one sees when a stick is thrust into water. They looked vague and shadowy in the peculiar circle of dark shadows which had such an extraordinary resemblance to the black mouth of a pit. I could see only the top of the table plainly, with Baines lying motionless on it, and the whole thing was going down as I stared into that black circle. There was not a moment to lose, and like a flash I caught Baines round his neck and body and lifted him clean up into my arms off the table. As I lifted him, he grunted like a great swine in my ear. The sound sent a thrill of horrible funk through me. It was just as though I held a hog in my arms instead of a human. I nearly dropped him. Then I held his face to the light and stared down at him. His eyes were half opened, and he was looking at me, apparently as if he saw me perfectly. Then he grunted again. I could feel his small body quiver with the sound. I called out to him, "Baines," I said, "can you hear me?" His eyes still glazed at me, and then as we looked at each other, he grunted like a swine again. I let go one hand and hit him across the cheek, a stinging slap. "Wake up, Baines," I shouted. "Wake up." But I might have hit a corpse. He just stared up at me. And suddenly, I bent lower and looked into his eyes more closely. I never saw such a fixed, intelligent, mad horror as I saw there. It knocked out all of my sudden disgust. Can you understand? I glanced round quickly at the table. I stood there at its normal height, and indeed, it was in every way normal. The curious shadow that somehow had suggested to me in the black mouth of the pit had vanished. I felt relieved, for it seemed to me that I had entirely broken up any possibility of a partial focus by means of the full defense which I had switched on. I laid Baines on the floor and stood up to look around and consider what was best to do. I dared not step outside of the barriers until any dangerous tensions there might be in the room had been dissipated. Nor was it wise, even inside the full defense, to have him sleeping the kind of sleep he was in, not without certain preparations having been made first, which I had not made. I can tell you I felt beastly anxious. I glanced down at Baines and had a sudden fresh shock, for the peculiar circular shadow was forming all around him again where he lay on the floor. His hands and face showed curiously vague and distorted, as they might have looked through a few inches of faintly stained water. But his eyes were somehow clear to see. They were staring up, mute and terrible at me, through that horrible darkening shadow. I stopped, and with one quick lift, tore him up off the floor into my arms, and for the third time, he grunted like a swine there in my arms. It was damnable. I stood up in the barrier, holding Baines, and looked about the room again, then back at the floor. The shadow was still thick round about my feet, and I stepped quickly across to the other side of the table. I stared at the shadow and saw that it had vanished. Then I glanced down again at my feet and had another shock, for the shadow was showing faintly again all around where I stood. I moved a pace and watched the shadow become invisible, and then, once more, like a slow stain, it began to grow about my feet. I moved again a pace and stared around the room, meditating a break for the door. And then, in an instant, I saw that this would certainly be impossible, for there was something indefinite in the atmosphere of the room, something that moved, circling slowly about the barrier. I glanced down at my feet and saw that the shadow had grown thick about them. I stepped a pace to the right, and as it disappeared, I stared again around the big room, and somehow it seemed tremendously big and unfamiliar. I wondered whether you can understand. As I stared, I saw again the indefinite something that floated in the air of the room. I watched it steadily for maybe a minute. It went twice completely round the barrier in that time, and suddenly I saw it more distinctly. It looked like a small puff of black smoke. And then I had something else to think about, for all at once I was aware of an extraordinary feeling of vertigo, and in the same moment a sense of sinking. I was sinking bodily. I literally sickened as I glanced down, for I saw in that moment that I had gone down, almost up to my thighs, into what appeared to be actually the shadowy but quite unmistakable mouth of a pit. Do you understand? I was sinking down into this thing with Baines in my arms. A feeling of furious anger came over me, and I swung my right foot forward with a fierce kick. I kicked nothing tangible, for I went clean through the side of the shadowy thing and fetched up against the table with a crash. I had come through something that made all my skin creep and tingle, an invisible, vague something which resembled an electric tension. I felt that if it had been stronger, I might not have been able to charge through as I had. I wonder if I make it clear to you. I whirled round, but the beastly thing had gone, yet even as I stood there by the table, the slow graying of a circular shadow began to form again about my feet. I stepped to the other side of the table and leaned against it for a moment, for I was shaking from head to foot, with a feeling of extraordinary horror upon me that was in some way different from any kind of horror I've ever felt. It was as if I had, in that one moment, been near something no human has any right to be near, for his soul's sake. And abruptly, I wondered whether I had not felt just one brief touch of the horror that the rigid Baines was even then enduring as I held him in my arms. Outside of the barrier there were now several of the curious little clouds. Each one looked exactly like a little puff of black smoke. They increased as I watched them, which I did for several minutes, but all the time as I watched I kept moving from one part to another of the defense so as to prevent the shadowy form round my feet again. Presently I found that my constant changing of positions had resolved into a slow, monotonous walk around and round inside the defense. And all the time I had to carry the unnaturally rigid body of poor Baines. It began to tire me, for though he was small, his rigidity made him dreadfully awkward and tiring to hold, as you can understand. Yet I could not think what else to do, for I had stopped shaking him or trying to wake him, for the simple reason that he was as wide awake as I was mentally, though but physically inanimate, through one of those partial spiritual disassociations which he had tried to explain to me. Now I had previously switched out of the red, orange, yellow, and green circles and had on the full defense of the blue end of the spectrum. I knew that one of the repelling vibrations of each of the three colors, blue, indigo, and violet, were beating out protectively into space. Yet they were proving insufficient, and I was in the position of having to either take some desperate action to stimulate Baines to an even greater effort of will than I judged him to be making, or else to risk experimenting with fresh combinations of the defensive colors. You see, as things were at the moment, the danger was increasing steadily, for plainly, from the appearance of the air of the room outside the barrier, there was some mighty dangerous tensions generating. While inside, the danger was also increasing, the steady recurrence of the shadow proving that the defense was insufficient. In short, I feared that Baines, in his peculiar condition, was literally a doorway into the defense, and unless I could wake him or find out the correct combination of circles necessary to set up stronger repelling vibrations against that particular danger, there were very ugly possibilities ahead. I felt I had been incredibly rash not to have foreseen the possibility of Baines falling asleep under the hypnotic effect of deliberately paralleling the associations of sleep. Unless I could increase the repulsions of the barriers or wake him, there was every likelihood of having to choose between a rush for the door, which the condition of the atmosphere outside the barrier showed to be practically impossible, or of throwing him outside the barrier, which, of course, was equally not possible. All this time I was walking round and round inside the barrier, when suddenly I saw a new development of the danger which threatened us. Right at the center of the defense, the shadow had formed into an intensely black circle, about a foot wide. This increased as I looked at it. It was horrible to see it grow. It crept out in an ever-widening circle till it was quite a yard across. Quickly I put Baines on the floor. A tremendous attempt was evidently going to be made by some outside force to enter the defense, and it was up to me to make a final effort to help Baines to wake up. I took up my lancet and pushed up his left coat sleeve. What I was going to do was a terrible risk, I knew, for there is no doubt that in some extraordinary fashion blood attracts. The Sigsand mentions it particularly in one passage, which runs something like this. In blood there is a voice which calleth through all space. Ye monsters and ye deep hear, and hearing they lust. Likewise hath it a greater power to reclaim backward ye soul that doth wander foolish, adrift from ye body, in which it doth have natural abiding. But woe unto him that doth spill ye blood in ye deadly hour, for there will be surely monsters that shall hear ye blood cry. That risk I had to run. I knew that the blood would call to the outer forces, but equally I knew that it would call even more loudly to that portion of Baines' essence that was adrift from him, down in those depths. Before lancing him, I glanced at the shadow. It had spread out until the nearest edge was not more than 2 feet away from Baines' right shoulder, and the edge was creeping nearer, like the blackening edge of burning paper, even while I stared. The whole thing had a less shadowy, less ghostly appearance than at any time before, and it looked simply and literally like the black mouth of a pit. "Now, Baines," I said, "pull yourself together, man. Wake up." And at that same time, as I spoke to him, I used my lancet quickly but superficially. I watched the little red spot of blood well up, then trickled round his wrist and fall to the floor of the defense. In the moment that it fell, the thing that I had feared happened. There was a sound like a low peal of thunder in the room, and curiously dead-looking flashes of light rippled here and there along the floor outside the barrier. Once more I called to him, trying to speak firmly and steadily, as I saw that the horrible shadowy circle had spread across every inch of the floor of the center of the defense, making it appear as if both Baines and I were suspended above an unutterable black void. The black void that stared up at me out of the throat of that shadowy pit. And yet, all the time, I could feel the floor solid under my knees as I knelt beside Baines, holding his wrist. "Baines!" I called once more, trying not to shout madly at him. "Baines, wake up! Wake up, man! Wake up!" But he never moved, only stared up at me with eyes of quiet horror that seemed to be looking at me out of some dreadful eternity. Thanks for joining me this week for tonight's regularly scheduled Tales of Terror. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Tonight's program is being brought to you by Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly, your host, Otis Gyre. Got a scary tale of your own you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to us today at submissions@chillingtalesfordarknights.com for your chance to have me bring your sinister story to life. If you enjoyed what you heard and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode, and leave us a 5-star review and a comment for your chance to be entered into a weekly prize drawing. Your feedback means a lot to us. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and bell notification icon to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs-up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. If you can never get enough spooky stories and can't wait until next week for more and haven't already, be sure to check out Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on YouTube for more than 500 free audio horror stories, or the Otis Gyre channel, my own digital home away from home, where you'll find dozens of previously released horror and sci-fi stories from yours truly. If you'd like to connect with or support me and CTFDN, visit the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights Facebook page or at their website, chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can support our programs by becoming a patron and get access to hundreds of stories, all ad-free. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with another pair of terrifying tales that'll keep you up all night.
Who needs sleep anyway?
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18+. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 100% match on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.